Welcome to the Wine Atelier Podcast, your insider's guide to mastering wine with certified sommelier Stephanie Miskew. Welcome to episode 17 of the Wine Atelier Podcast. Today on the show, I am thrilled to continue Women's History Month with another amazing Venice trailblazer, founding winemaker and CEO of Domaine Carneros, aka America's doyen of sparkling wine, Eileen Crane. Thanks so much for joining me today, Eileen.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
And I have to say, when I first started this podcast last year, I started with like a list of like 10 people that I most wanted to interview, and you were definitely at the top of that list. Your story is so inspiring, and I'm a huge fan of your wines, and I think I've actually started a cult following of the Cuvée de la Pompadour Brut Rosé here in town. It's delicious, but your story really is so inspiring. And why don't we start at the beginning? Where did your love of food and wine begin? Is that something that started at home, or did you kind of discover it on your own later?
No, I did not discover it at home. My father had landed on D-Day in the morning and survived. And while he was in Europe, he tasted first French wines and then German wines. And he fell in love with wine. And when he came home, he started a wine cellar, which is very unusual at the time. Mm-hmm. I grew up in that great winemaking state, New Jersey. But he had a wine cellar back then. And from about the time I was eight, he was... let me taste the wine. On Sundays, it was the only day we had wine. It was for a Sunday dinner. Mm-hmm. And it got to be kind of a thing that I would help him pick out the wine for Sunday dinner. My suggestions were mostly based upon the pictures on the labels. But
good place to start.
Good place to start, yeah. And then one day he pulled out a bottle of champagne, and I got to taste it, and I thought, well, this is it. And every Sunday I tried to talk him into another bottle of champagne, and he'd negotiate. Like, oh, honey, you know, in 3 or 4 weeks, Aunt Elsie and Uncle Ray will come, and then we'll open the bottle. But not, you know, because I think he thought it was a wee bit too much every Sunday. I personally wouldn't have thought that was too much, but he did.
So. Great. That's funny. So, all right. So your love of champagne started early. And so how did that influence you and your studies and as far as your passion for studying food and wine and making that kind of your career?
Well, when I was growing up, you became a winemaker because you were born into an Italian family in upstate New York. And you were, of course, a guy. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea, really. I mean, we saw wine. I lived on the East Coast, and we saw mostly wines from New York. And so I had other careers. I did other different things. I did social work in Venezuela. While I was there, I became very interested in nutrition and went to the University of Connecticut, did my graduate degree in nutrition and biochemistry. And then...
Wow.
And the Culinary Institute of America was founded by two women in the middle of the 40s. And it had been originally in New Haven, Connecticut, where I was living after graduate school. I taught for the University of Connecticut for a couple of years. Wow. And I took a summer off, and I went to the CIA in Hyde Park. It was a 10-week class, very intensive. And while I was there, I joined a wine club, and there was this young winemaker whose father had the first premium winery in the Hudson River Valley.
Wow.
And he gave this class, and he had this book called The Art of Winemaking.
Mm.
And I looked through the book, and I said, well, this is published by the University of California, Davis. Do they have a winemaking school? Wow. He said, I don't know. I know they've had, you know, books from there, but I don't know. So I called up Davis. I asked for the enology department. By this time, I knew what it was called. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, no, we don't have an enology department. We have a fermentation science department. I said, okay, put me through. And they, and I ended up talking to a professor, an older professor, and I told him what I wanted to do. And he said, well, you know, nobody will hire you because as a woman, you will not be able to do the barrel work. And you're going to have to spend 4 years doing an undergraduate degree, another 2 years in graduate school, and really, nobody is going to hire you.
Wow.
So why don't you let me call over to the nutrition department and see if you could work on a PhD in nutrition? And I said, well, I don't suggest you do that because I'm going to be a winemaker. And he said, I don't think so. But he did do me one big favor.
Uh-huh.
He said there was a new woman professor at Davis named Anne, oh my goodness, I'm drawing a blank. Famous woman for the aroma wheel.
And, oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then it'll come to me probably about 2 in the morning. I'll give you a call.
Right. You let me know. I'll be here.
Okay. So he called up and made an appointment. I went over and talked to her. And she said, you know, you don't need another degree. Come and take some classes and convince somebody you can do it.
Great.
Completely different story. And that's what I did. I took some classes and started actually as a part-time tour guide at Shandong. They had opened up, oh, just a year before.
Yeah.
Or less. And they were looking for, I wanted to get my foot in the door. And it was mid-May, and I knew they wouldn't be hiring for people in the winemaking department just yet. So I took a job there part-time, almost starved that summer. And then they had a restaurant, and their pastry chef quit, and they asked me, because I'd been at the culinary, would I go down and do the pastries? And I was doing that about 2 weeks in. And the young woman who was the chemist came down and found me. She said, well, the winemaker just quit, and I'm going to be running the harvest.
Wow.
Would you like to work? And she just said, would you like to work in the lab? It's a 6-week job. And I said, yes. And I left 6 years later and have become the assistant winemaker.
Oh my gosh, that is amazing. That in and of itself, I mean, so many people would have initially, when the guy said, there's no way you're ever going to be a winemaker. I mean, I have to say most women might just said, okay, you know, not for me. So this is what happens when you persist. And I mean, was it your passion that was just kind of driving you the whole way? Like you just really knew you were right for this job?
Well, I didn't know that I was right. I certainly knew that that's what I wanted.
And I was gotcha.
And I was bound and determined. I mean, I gave up a tenure track at the University of Connecticut.
Wow.
And drove across country and sought this out and was willing, obviously, very different pay and that sort of thing. And I just really, really wanted to do this. And sometimes people, like, find their passion and find it early, and some people don't. I know of someone who was given a book on Egypt when he was about 6 years old, a child's book, and he decided that he was totally interested in Egypt and ended up an Egyptologist with a specialty in animal mummies. And he just knew this at 6 years old, he wanted to do this.
That's amazing. So
it's kind of like, and some people don't think they ever find their real métier or their real career that they wanted. But I think if you really want something, you go after it. And I've mentored women and other people as well. And sometimes people say, well, I have to make this much money. And if you have to make that much money, you really can't start over in a new career necessarily. You have to be willing to go in the necessary years and the learning.
Yeah.
experience. So I was very willing to do that. It was important to me.
That's great. Me too. I came to the wine industry kind of late, and you do what you have to do to get into it. I mean, you just do, and you definitely did. So you took the position as winemaker at Chandon, and what happened from there?
No.
Assistant.
I became the assistant winemaker at Chandon, and then I was hired by the Freixenet Group to build Gloria Ferrer.
Wow.
So in 1984, I thought they were hiring me to be the winemaker, but they, took the job, had given up my other job, and I assumed that they had, project manager, someone who would run it. And I said, well, our winemaker in Spain builds the wineries. He does the construction for us, so you can do that. And I said, oh. So, and I actually did. So I found I'm good at checking references. I found a very good contractor. I found a good consultant who could help me through the project. And the winery actually completed within the time frame and within just a few percent over budget. So it went very well. It went fine. But I think what really saved me on that job. Mm-hmm. Was that I'm good at checking references and finding assistance. I didn't think I could just do it all on my own. I knew I couldn't.
Good. So you knew to kind of delegate, surround yourself with capable, great people. And mm-hmm. Wow, that's interesting. And at this time, who are the other sparkling winemakers in the area? Was there any friction between you and them? Or was it more of a what was that like, that in that regard?
Well, there are very few sparkling houses in the United States. And mm-hmm. At the time, there probably were about six of us, maybe seven of us, mm-hmm. who were in the sparkling wine business. And we needed to be pals.
Yeah.
Because if something went wrong, we needed to be able to help each other out and... the champagne, everybody makes champagne, and they've got companies that play to champagne makers, but all of our equipment came from Europe, et cetera, et cetera. So we needed to be there for each other. And it was great because we learned from each other, mm-hmm. and it was also much more comfortable. Sparkling wine is a very complex product to make, far harder to make than wines without bubbles.
Absolutely.
And, so we really needed to work together, and that was a great thing. It was a real esprit de corps that we were doing this.
Wonderful. And for everybody listening, in the resource notes, I will link up to an article on the details about how sparkling wine and champagne are made, because it is a very intricate process. Now, were you the only woman in that group of winemakers at the time?
Well, no, yeah, actually, the woman at Chandon was the winemaker. There were no other women. So it was she and I that were, there were no other women at the time in the sparkling wine world.
Right.
There were certainly some women in the still wine world, not a lot, but there were.
Gotcha. But really, in the sparkling wine world, it was pretty much you two ladies. And, So you've completed the construction of that winery, and then how does it kind of come to the point where you find out about Claude Tattinger and that he's looking, and how does that kind of come about?
Well, I was at Gloria, mm-hmm. and I just got in the building up, and by the way, I'm probably the first woman to have, post-prohibition, to have actually built a major winery.
Wow.
Got a winery built and up and functional. But I was, the industry is small. The Tattinger came through to visit this area. They've developed a partnership with a marketing company that they've been with for 30 or 40 years, called Cobrand.
Right.
And they partnered together. And so, the Cobrand people and the Tattinger people came out to visit, see what was going on. And of course, the closest house, one of the two closest houses to where I am, or where Domingue Carneros is, was Gloria, and I had just was in the process of completing the construction. So they came by, and, you know, as I said, we're very collegial, particularly in Sparkling, because we're a small group, and I show them around, and I tell them what we were doing, and blah, blah, blah. And then maybe a few months later, the man who had created Sequoia Grove and was running Sequoia Grove, he called me up. He was kind of their contact in California for the project.
Yeah.
And he called me up and he said, you know, the changers are coming back for a visit, and they'd like to have you meet with them. And and I said, well, I've seen they've been advertising for Kid out of Davis. And I said, you know, I'm running Glory for this is not. And then he said, well, they think they need a Kid out of Davis, but they need someone who can really run this project. Would you be willing to come and talk to them? I said, I don't have a resume. And he said, well, just come and talk. So I went and talked to them.
Yeah.
And then they asked me to come back 2 days later and to talk to them again. But frankly, within the first 15 minutes, I think we both knew it was a match.
Really? So it was that kind of instantaneous?
It really was. I mean, I knew what they were looking for. I knew that they were very committed to quality, which is enormously important to me. That they had a style that was a more elegant style, and that's the style of wine that I like to make. I don't like heavy wine, and that's not what they do. So there was really it was really almost perfect. It couldn't have been with how few winemakers there were in California or with any kind of experience with sparkling wine. And at the same time, not only did I have the Method Champenoise experience, but I also had the construction experience and developing a winery. I brought in people for an accounting office, for running a tasting room, et cetera, et cetera, the vineyard production, et cetera. So that's how I met them, and it came a couple of different times to talk to me.
You were kind of like exactly what they needed, right? I mean, they pretty much, all of your skill set pretty much aligned exactly with what they were looking for. And when you initially met with them, did they say like they needed like a winemaker as well as someone to oversee the building of the winery? Or was it more just the winemaking angle at first?
Well, it was, the winemaking was, of course, the first thing, and the construction, getting the building up and making the wines, because you need to start. I needed to make wine, start to make wines immediately. They wanted to have something available to sell when they opened the winery.
Gotcha.
So they really, and I, you know, I'd also done the other things, like overseeing the development of a tasting room at Gloria. I'd overseen. Putting in place the infrastructure that you need at a winery, and et cetera, et cetera. So they, the title I had at that time was managing director, which is a European term, which means basically that I was managing the whole operation.
Gotcha.
And you know, that changed over time to CEO, or president and then CEO, because they weren't familiar with the terms CEO. So anyway, so they needed someone that was the complete package, and you know, they showed me architectural drawings, and I knew what the issues were and what where the tweaks needed and what were the great ideas, and just things like that. So it was a really a match all the way around, and has been for the last 31 years. Yes.
Well, how amazing is that? I mean, there's not many people in any profession, I think, that can really say that, which is part of, I think, what makes this so incredibly special. I mean, it really is. It really is.
It really was match made heaven, yes.
Wonderful. And so when you're like embarking on this, and I'm just thinking like from my own perspective, like you're coming up with this portfolio of sparkling wines and, you know, overseeing the construction of a winery, is that like an overwhelming time? Is it an exciting time or a mix of both? Or, you know, how did that feel at the time?
Well, when I first did the Gloria thing, it was very overwhelming because I hadn't done I mean, I had the winemaking part, but I really had no experience in any other part of it. But I have a good business sense. My dad worked on Wall Street for 45 years. So I have a real business, and I understand what makes companies successful, et cetera. And so, but by the time I got to Domaine Carneros, I built a winery of a substantial size.
Yeah.
And so I understood the construction. And it also was an opportunity to kind of put into place the skills I had learned, had hardwired.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was very nice. And subsequently, I also built a Pinot Noir facility behind Domaine Carneros.
Man.
As we branched into that, we do make a still Pinot Noir, a red Pinot Noir.
Right.
And it's about 20% of our production. Clearly, our sparkling wine is the main thing. But it was very nice. I think it was kind of almost exuberant to be able to do this again and have the skills to build the winery, to get it up and running. And that was very exciting.
That's
of course, it's always hard, but yeah.
Right. Challenging, but right. You had done both of these things before, and to kind of roll the two into one project must have been exhilarating. So that's wonderful.
Yeah.
So what was the first wine you made with them, and how did the portfolio of sparkling wines kind of evolve?
Well, we started out with the classic Brut, which is the most widely produced probably in the world, in the method Champenoise method, traditional way. And so we started with that, with just simply one wine. And shortly after I was hired, I got a call from Claude Kaitinger. And he said to me, you know, we have the finest Blanc de Blanc champagne in the world. And someday, I would like to have the finest Blanc de Blanc from America. And it sounded, I'd done a Blanc de Blanc, which is all Chardonnay.
Yes.
I'd done a trial on that in the past, but I'd never produced one that was commercially released. So he asked me this, and I think he kind of hear the gulp. You know, we think in terms of decades. We think in terms of lifetimes. He said, take your time. We know this isn't going to happen overnight. And so I just started work on that. We did some prototypes for our Blanc de Blanc. And in 91, we started in 88, 91, Claude Tanger tasted our blend, or pre-blend, or cuvee. It was a sparkling. And when I sent the juice over, or the wines, we call them base wines, but they're the components that go into the sparkling wine.
Gotcha.
He tasted it and he called me and he said, "The 92. If the 92 is as good, we will have our first Blanc de Blanc."
Oh.
And he ordered a special bottle with a double ram head. Carneros is Spanish for sheep or ram. And so he had a special bottle created for the 92, hoping that would turn out well, and it did.
Oh, wonderful!
And then we needed a name, and it started out that my husband suggested Reverie, but that name was taken.
Oh, okay.
So we decided to shorten it to Rev, but that kind of sounded like revving an engine.
Yeah, right.
And then we put the Le Rev in front of it, and everybody was happy with that. So that's
perfect.
How it was. And Le Rev, and of course, Le Rev means the dream. I like to think of it as the dream come true, because I always feel, yeah, I had an opportunity to do my utmost or my very best work, and to have that now, or since its release in 98.
How wonderful.
No
kidding.
Thank you.
That is wonderful. And as far as like your winemaking style went, you know, you had been making sparkling wine for a little while before you met the Tattinger family. How did they have influenced the way you made wine, sparkling wine, at the time? Yeah.
Well, you know, they tasted the wines I had made, and we talked about style. And by the time they hired me, they were pretty comfortable with what I was doing.
Right.
And Claude Tate, I remember we had dinner at his house a couple of years after I was hired, and he said, "No, we are of Champagne, you are of Carneros. Our wines will not be the same." Mm-hmm. And he said, "We do our best in Champagne, you will do your best in Carneros." So they've never said, a lot of the French houses, the Champagne houses, the sparkling houses, have had someone come over and spend a week or two creating the blends. And we've never done that. They've always, that's always been my job to create the wines.
Wonderful.
And that makes much more sense because you have much more experience with the vineyards and
absolutely
how the wines will turn out, how they age, yes.
Yes. So then after Le Rêve and the Brut, how did you kind of the other wines in the portfolio evolve? There was obviously the Cuvée de la Pompadour that I'm a huge fan of, but the other wines as well. I mean, and you know, you're such a lovely portfolio today. How did they kind of come about? And did that have anything to do with, because I know you own a lot of your own, you know, estate vineyards, which is also kind of rare. A lot of sparkling winemakers generally purchase grapes, but you primarily own most of your own fruit, correct?
That's correct. We own about currently we're at about 90%. We purchased a few years ago the another vineyard in the Carneros, and we're 100% Carneros. We purchased another vineyard, and within the next 4 years, we will be 100% estate. And
wonderful.
You can never buy grapes of the quality you can produce, in my opinion. And
listening, yeah, why is that? What are the benefits of, you know, owning your own estate vineyards as compared to purchasing grapes?
Well, you have control over how the grapes are grown. You have control over the clones. There are different types of grapes. You think Chardonnay is Chardonnay, but no, there are dozens of types of Chardonnay. So you can pick those, choose those. The system by which the vines are trained, the spacing that you want, the pruning dates, the types of irrigation and fertilizing, and when the grapes are picked, and when you're relying on someone from the outside, they may have several customers, and you have to wait, or you have to give picking instructions well in advance. When you have your own grapes, you can make all those choices the way you want them to be. And so, buying grapes, if you buy from, there are very many good and reputable growers.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, we buy a little bit of Merlot from Larry Hyde, not really Merlot producers, but winemakers like to play. And he grows great, wonderful Merlot grapes. And we buy from him, but Chardonnay and Pinot Noir are the backbone of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very strongly that being 100% estate for quality is enormously important.
No kidding. Do you grow any Pinot Meunier?
We did a trial shortly after I was hired. We did a little trial, I think it was 5 acres, and then it fell to Quaxer and we replaced it with Pinot Noir. Meunier is the most widely planted grape in Champagne. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's planted, first of all, it buds out later than the Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. So if they have a hard frost and they lose part of the Pinot Noir crop, they've got the Meunier, which is also a red grape, still coming along. So it's sort of, it's a little insurance policy in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is Meunier ages more rapidly. So it gives more of a sense of age without having to keep the wine in the bottle for as long as you would if on a vintage wine. So the Meunier, in Champagne, you can release a non-vintage Champagne at 18 months, whereas the vintage is 3 years. So, and we don't have those regulations in the United States, but the good houses generally follow the French regulations. We have not gone back to our federal government and asked for more regulations. We've just kind of adopted the French ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because we, as in almost all cases, we age our wines at least 3 years and more, and often 4 or 5 years.
Gotcha.
we don't need the Meunier. We don't like what it adds to the mix.
Right.
We don't have the problem with the cross. So we're in a very different place than, and the, in general, the more expensive you, bottle of champagne is, the less and less Meunier there is in the bottle. So the Chapin was understand that this is not the top grape, that the Chardonnay is probably the most appreciated grape in Champagne, and then Pinot Noir, and last, Meunier.
Amen. No, thank you so much for explaining that, because you really don't see it much in California, and now we know why. That's wonderful. So what do you think kind of sets Domaine Carneros sparkling wines like apart from some of the other, you know, sparkling wine houses in Napa? What makes y'all kind of more unique?
Well, first of all, we own so much more of our own vineyards, mm-hmm. and we're 100% Carneros. So there, you know, for instance, Chandon uses a California appellation. Schramsberg uses a North Coast appellation. Mm-hmm. But we are in the Carneros. Now, the Carneros is a very cool region, and like Champagne. So it's very similar to Champagne. So we have a real appellation, cold appellation, cool appellation. And so that's one of the things that sets us aside from the other producers. And another thing is the longevity of the winemaker. You know, when you make wine, you don't make it only once a year.
Mm-hmm.
So I have the great luxury of having worked with most of our vineyards for a decade or decades longer. So I've learned how to work with those grapes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you make a wine, you know, you don't have to taste it right away. So we don't see the finished product. So even our fruit, we've aged that from the time we make the blend, it's going to be probably 4 years before it's released. So when I taste, I have to be able to project what this is going to taste like in 4 or more years.
Gosh.
And if you start out as a winemaker with new vineyards, different clones, et cetera, it's much, much harder to do that. We're also smaller. We're the smallest sparkling house in Napa. Chandon, Schramsberg, and Mumm are all larger than we are.
Yeah.
So we're small, kind of boutique producer. And mm-hmm. And something else is, you think the style of the wine, if you want consistency or someone who spends time with it, the winemaker at a fine winery sets the style, sets the palate, sets the taste.
Yeah.
And, you know, like when you go out to dinner at the French Laundry,
mm-hmm.
you are tasting Thomas Keller's palate. It's not somebody else dictating what he must do. And so I've been here long enough and with that level of experience that I can, based on my palate, I can do certain things. I understand how it's going to be coming out. And if winemakers change over, it takes, I think, about 10 years to get down a consistent palate and to understand
really
what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Oh, that is so amazing. And the consistency of you being there and being with them since they started. I mean, that really is so, so incredibly special. And to be able to go back and taste the wines that you've crafted from 10 years ago or longer ago. And right, like you really get a handle on how they age, which obviously informs like how you make wine in the future. What an amazing and wonderful opportunity. And how would you say your role of winemaker has changed since you first kind of accepted the job in 1987, right? Is that when you kind of accepted the job with the Tattingers?
Yes, in 1987.
87, yeah. Is that what I said? I hope so.
Yeah. Well, my first part was to get the wines made. That I didn't have a facility of my own at that point. I put together an arrangement with a couple of other wineries, but I spent time constructing the building, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I'm still the winemaking is still a big part of my job, but I also do, as you know, like, for instance, this interview today, I do a fair amount of public relations work.
Oh, okay.
And we are known for our hospitality far and wide. Jermaine Carnass has a wonderful tasting room.
Oh, it's beautiful. Beautiful. Tell people a little bit. Isn't it modeled after one of the chateaux in the Chateau de la Marqueterie?
Yeah, the Chateau de la Marqueterie is owned by the Champagne Tainter family.
Mm-hmm.
And the chateau was used as a model. It's not an exact replica, but it was the Chateau de la Marqueterie was the inspiration for this chateau.
Beautiful.
And and it's not identical because that is a home, very mm-hmm. big home, but nevertheless. And then, of course, recently we've added this beautiful Jardin d'Hiver or conservatory off the north terrace of Jermaine Carnass, which has got some of the most stunning views in the valley.
It sounds amazing. Oh, my gosh.
And you can sit out there in a winter storm and look over the great views and be totally protected. It's really wonderful. And we're doing a fun thing right now. We're doing something called Bubbles and Asian Bites. So we're matching Asian cuisines with our wines. People, you know, often think of the traditional, like caviar and cheeses. Mm-hmm. Not that I object to any of those things with wine bubbles, but I think often people don't know how to pair wines with Asian cuisines, and fine sparkling wine is really a perfect choice. And so we do this wonderful tasting of bubbles and Asian bites. It's really kind of a fun thing, but also an educational and fine thing. Yes.
That sounds positively dreamy. And I'd love to ask you, I know a lot of people, here in the States anyway, obviously we think of sparkling wine as being only, you know, only at celebrations and special occasions and New Year's Eve. But what are your thoughts on pairing sparkling wine with food? And do you have any particular favorites you'd like to share?
Well, you know, I think sparkling wine should only be for special occasions. And my favorite special occasion is Friday night.
Cheers to that.
And I also, you know, and Saturday night could be another special occasion as well. and you know, at Monday at lunch, it may turn that rather plebeian meal into a great thing to remember. So,
I love the way you think.
Well, you know, sparkling wine is just, it's a very versatile wine. I fell in love the first time over a bottle of champagne and filet mignon.
Oh,
now, I can't promise the same results to everybody, but it sure worked for me. So,
Me too. My favorite pairing with a New York strip is a Brut Rosé sparkling wine. It's so delicious. I find like the bubbles, like they almost take the place of tannin in a red wine. Like it has more body than people think or give it credit for.
Yeah.
But, it's heavenly.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that, but the tannins give you texture on your palate, and what with sparkling wine, the bubbles give you the texture. That's wonderful. Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, of course. Hey.
Gals got to work together.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's wonderful. So definitely, everyone listening, if you're planning a trip out to California wine country, be sure to, you know, take time and visit Jermaine Carnass. And it's such a beautiful, beautiful place. And and tying back to our Women's History Month, what advice would you give to women who maybe want to get into the wine business today? You know, especially those maybe considering a career in winemaking. Is there anything in particular you would share with them?
Well, yes. I mean, having a background in actually an enology program at Davis, and there are other schools that do that as well, that have enology departments, Fresno State, for instance, and other states have them. So having an educational background in enology is an important thing, or a good background in science, especially if you want to go into the winemaking side. Of course, you can get into the wine industry in a number of ways that are not in winemaking. Mm. For instance, you could maybe start in a tasting room, work your way up, and end up running tasting room or running direct-to-client programs. I mean, there are various things that you can do.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I don't think a lot of people really are aware of all the different positions within a winery, right? You could run the tasting room, you could do marketing, or that's a very good point.
Yeah, absolutely. You could be an accountant. So there are all these mm-hmm. different, you might be an executive assistant. There are lots of positions that need to be filled in the wine industry, HR. It's just a matter of what, you know, are you willing to, you want to live fairly close to, obviously, where there are wineries, mm-hmm. Find a job first and then move to it, or if there's some place that makes wine near you, what the openings are. And I find that if you're persistent, if someone's persistent, usually, yeah. and sometimes persistent over years, you're probably going to eventually succeed.
That's true. Hear that, everyone? Persistence pays off. That's very, very good advice. Good advice. And that's true. Now that most states actually, you know, do make some sort of wine, you could, right, you don't necessarily have to go out to California to get the experience. You can work at a, check out a local winery or something like that.
Yeah, and there, you know, New York State has a substantial group of wines. I mean, there are a number of wineries and in Texas, for instance, there are a large
right.
number of wineries. So you don't have to be in California. And you don't have to be in Northern California. And, of course, then there's Oregon and Washington. So you don't need to move to Napa.
Great.
Where the housing is unbelievably expensive. But yeah.
Yes, that's true. I know, because that's probably one of the questions I get asked the most. People are very curious. Well, how do you get into the wine business? So good. I think that advice is extremely helpful. Gosh, I got to tell you right now, I wish I was at that beautiful Jardin du Verre on the terrace at Domaine Carneros. That sounds so beautiful. Do you have anything else, any other future plans for the Domaine or any new releases or anything else coming up or special events?
Well, we do. I'd say that the special event that I would encourage people to sign up for would be the Bubbles and Asian Bites.
Gotcha.
And that is weekdays at, I believe it's 11 o'clock. But you can call the winery.
Cool.
And we are open by reservation 7 days a week.
Good.
And we have, especially right now, we have with the nice warm weather during the day, great time to sit out on the terraces of Domaine Carneros.
Oh, how nice!
it's wonderful. We have these wonderful tastings of like three different sparkling wines. We even have tastings of our Pinot Noir, et cetera. So there's lots of things to try. But I really encourage people to make reservations. We are very busy.
Good. So you hear that, everyone? Make your reservations before you head out there. And I promise you it will be well worth it. Eileen, thank you so much for joining me today. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. So good to talk to you.
Great. And for those of you listening, you can find all of the resources mentioned in today's show on my website at theglamorousgourmet.com/episode17. And if you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to hit that subscribe button. I've got lots and lots of fabulous food and wine fun to share with you. And thank you so much for tuning in today.